We've heard from the governor, we've heard from legislative leadership, and we've heard from lawmakers in both chambers on both sides of the aisle. As we take stock of the Indiana General Assembly's unprecedented 2021 session, it's time we heard from the people who chronicled lawmakers' actions day in and day out for the past 4 months. Hi, I'm John Schwanis, and on this week's show, our last of the season, we'll do just that as we sit down with three highly respected members of the State House Press Corps. Don't go away. Indiana lawmakers, from the State House to your house. And joining me to assess the just completed 2021 legislative session are Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting and host of Indiana Week in Review, which, as I like to say, airs on many of these same public broadcasting stations. Lindsay Erdody, WFYI digital editor for Education and Health. And Erica Heron, education reporter for the Indianapolis Star. Thank you all for emerging from the fog, post-session fog, to enlighten us. You know, I should probably make one semi-correction. I said just concluded session of the General Assembly. In a something of an unprecedented move, it's sort of the end, but they will be back in the fall. So instead of adjourning sine die, they just sort of gaveled it into recess, and back we come. So one of the many things different from this session.
It was definitely a weird way to close things out of sorts.
Well, this has been a weird session, I would argue, in lots of ways. And I think we all would have stipulated back, certainly before January, that this would be the COVID session. And it was. I mean, we saw liability protections. We saw lots of recovery dollars being funneled to students and schools and businesses and so forth. We also saw some measures such as visitation rights for caregivers at nursing homes. So there were measures. But is this the kind of COVID-19 session that we expected? I was surprised we got through without interruptions.
Yeah, that was maybe the it might be the biggest surprise of the session, is that we didn't have an interruption. I think everybody kind of expected an interruption of some kind due to a COVID-19 outbreak. And credit to legislative leaders, credit to staff who did incredible work just rearranging the way we do session to make it as safe as it could be.
Different way of testifying. People were doing
sometimes separated in different rooms.
Different rooms.
Lots of
plexiglass. We all only wished we had gone into the plexiglass business probably 10 years ago. We'd all be retired now. And in fact, new locations for the House. They were in Indiana Government Center South. I mean, Lindsay Erdody, did this work? I mean, I guess it worked because they got their work done early even, and it was a pretty broad agenda.
Yeah, I think it worked the best it could. Like, there were certainly things that came up here and there with chairs of committees being able to control who's testifying and what's going on because they're in completely separate rooms. You know, and being able to enforce mask wearing, different things like that did come up. But I mean, for the sake of, we didn't have a shutdown. I mean, I think it went as smooth as it could for as weird of a session as it was.
And of course, we ended up with lots of money, arguably far more money than the state would have had without a pandemic. So, Erica, let me ask you kind of a, this may sound like a rude question. Certainly, I'm not suggesting there's anything good about a pandemic. Lots of Hoosiers lost loved ones, lost their lives, lost their livelihood. Terrible thing. But I mean, just looking at it narrowly from the fiscal standpoint, is this the lottery ticket that, to a certain extent, that came in for Hoosier lawmakers?
It felt a little bit like the state had hit the jackpot when we got that updated revenue forecast and found out there was another $2 billion to spend. I don't think anyone saw that coming, and I think, as Brandon may have mentioned earlier, I don't think we would have seen that without the pandemic, without a lot of the steps that nationally and at the state level people took to try and address it. Indiana's definitely been made financially whole, I think you could say. I
mean, and then some.
We've recovered, yes, even if individual Hoosiers haven't, like the state financially definitely has.
And that $2 billion, we should point out, that was in the revised forecast, the additional tax revenue for the state, that didn't even... yes, there were some federal dollars, you might say a trickle-down effect, but that doesn't even count for the federal dollars that came into the state as a result of direct COVID relief and that may eventually flood into the state here in the form of infrastructure investment. So That leads us to the budget. You know, we had only five people in both chambers vote against the budget.
Two of them were Republicans.
Two Republicans. And they're still in the woodshed. I think I heard some faint moaning.
I don't think they ever left the woodshed, those two particular Republicans.
Well, they have thick hide. They probably can maybe put up with it anyway. But it was a surprise to see so few people oppose it. I mean, that's historic.
If I said that the biggest surprise of the session was that we didn't have a stop or a halt because of COVID-19, I would say the other biggest surprise of the session is that there were only five votes out of 150 against the budget. Certainly unprecedented in my decade here, talking to people who've been around longer. They don't remember anything like that.
Democrats who criticized elements of the budget, or I should say parts of the budget that weren't there, that they wanted to see additional funding and support, they almost were hard-pressed to say mean things.
Yeah, it was begrudging a lot of times. Like, we saw multiple Democrats get up on the floor in the House and the Senate and be like, I really can't vote against this budget, kind of thing, like almost through gritted teeth. The way the Democrats, I think, spun it in a lot of cases was, you know, well, this is thanks to President Joe Biden and Democrats in Congress who passed the American Rescue Plan, got more money into people's pockets, which helps account for the $2 billion extra dollars that we saw in the forecast, and a lot of the $3 billion in one-time spending that's part of this new state.
Do constituents care about that, or they just say, hey, I got more
money
in my pocket?
You got money. But it's a way for Democrats to be able to say, this is why I'm supporting it, because of Democratic work. And, you know, we've been fighting for a lot of the things that you finally put in the budget, so we can support it. That was shocking.
I mean, Lindsay, we've seen the threshold at which criticism of philosophical concerns or criticism of certain political moves and machinations basically disappear in the face of overwhelming amounts of money. I mean, did money buy silence or placate everybody? Is it as simple as that?
Yeah, I think a little bit, because the budget really has like a little something for everyone in it this year. Because of all of that extra money, they were able to increase spending in all these areas, or, you know, throw money into programs that they otherwise wouldn't have been able to do, that kind of made everyone be like, well, this is okay, sure, you know. And since the budget's passed at the end of the session, what I found interesting was it seemed like everyone kind of had this like come together moment at the end of session, passing the budget with hardly any votes against it. And it was almost like we forgot about some of the other things that happened earlier on in the session that people didn't really like and that we had fights over. You know, it just seemed like this, you know, we wrapped up this session on this happy note, I guess.
About the only gap, if you want to say, or ammunition for critics, and we talked about this on Week in Review, was the failure of the budget architects to give those who received unemployment benefits from the state during COVID a pass on state income tax. You know, businesses are getting debts forgiven left and right, and they're seeing an increase in the state's contribution to the unemployment compensation fund, which means that the taxes won't go up in all likelihood on businesses. Is that sort of the one sticking point that critics of this budget can say, gee, you really are looking like Ebenezer Scrooge on this one? And does that have any lasting political implications?
I don't know if it'll have lasting political implications, because I don't know that the kind of philosophy behind it is really a surprise or anything different than, you know, people would expect. But it was certainly one sticking point. The other sticking point from the budget was the expansion of the school choice programs and the voucher program. The other thing that I think that's what we heard, honestly, the most kind of negative talk about, the most criticism of in this budget. You had a lot of Democrats getting up and saying, I really can't support this piece of it. And actually, I think the couple of Democrats that did vote against it said they were doing so because of that piece.
If you had stood back, again, we can play a lot of this game today. If we were talking before the session and we had said, you know, Democrats are going to throw their support for a budget measure that puts hundreds of millions of dollars, potentially in additional dollars, into the choice program through new savings accounts, by raising the threshold at which families can receive assistance, voucher assistance. It's now at 300% of the federal free and reduced loan program. That's what, $145,000 for a family of four? That's pretty generous. I mean, Is that the, that probably is the classic example of buying off your critics, right? I mean, under what is there any circumstance under which most Democrats would have swallowed that had they not been getting $1.9 billion in new money for K through 12?
Well, it's not just that. It's I think what probably bought, and we heard Democrats talk about this on the floor in the House, certainly, where every Democrat in the House voted for this budget. I think what was able to get their yes vote was not just that you were spending all this new money on education, but that for the first time, the entire session, Republicans finally put some stuff in the budget for teacher compensation. I mean, we talked, I think, at the halfway point about how we were surprised that not a single recommendation from the governor's teacher compensation commission,
or whatever there were,
single one had been acted upon by the majorities at the State House. And then right at the end, with all this new money, they put in that schools have to spend 45% of their per pupil funding on educator salaries. They can't lower that. Going forward,
whatever you set that at, you can't lower 40,000. Although I guess there's some wiggle room there. If a district violates that, they can write a report to the teacher, to the state,
and then putting a little more than $600 million per year into the into the foundation. Again, another recommendation of the Teacher Compensation Commission. I think that was. You can't say no to that.
You can't vote against teacher pay.
And it was finally a way that everyone could agree that it was actually something they were doing for teachers.
And again, it's not just money, but it's that notion of setting some, this percentage will go there, which is a departure from this notion that, school boards, you know what's best, we can only wheedle and cajole. I mean, is this the last time we've heard about teacher compensation for a while? And more broadly, clearly students took a heavy hit because of COVID. I mean, we don't really know test scores, and schools won't be held. They'll be held harmless initially for scores and so forth. But let's assume that kids took a hit in learning. Is this even this incredible amount of money? Is this enough to get the job done for getting kids caught back up and getting teachers happy to be in the classroom?
I guess we'll see what happens, I think, is the best answer to that. Because now it is on the locals to take the money, take this, new requirement, take the $40,000 salary recommendation and act on it. And like we said, that's a recommendation. They don't necessarily have to. They have to explain why if they don't. But, we'll see how it goes. And then I think if we don't see a significant increase in teacher pay and things improving in that regard, then I think there's going to be more discussions. We kind of heard Speaker Houston make comments about that. Like, if you don't do this, we're going to come back and really talk this out, because we're giving you the money now to make this happen. So make it happen.
So maybe at least a brief respite from talk about that until the checks are written and cashed.
Well, I think you see most districts do that. I think you see most districts giving a raise to teachers. I think you see most districts getting up to or close to that 40,000. Now, most of them aren't there yet at 40,000 starting pay, but they're close. A lot of them are in that 35 to 40 range. So I think most of them do raise starting pay to 40K. You saw in the last budget, they gave, what was it, 700, 800 million to new money to schools. And almost all districts gave their teachers a raise. So with this amount of money, I think you see that happen. I don't think that there haven't been teacher raises because districts just don't want to pay their teachers more. I think if they have the money to do it, I think they will.
And something that'll help too is that there are going to be things that schools need to spend money on this summer, next year, when you talk about recovering that learning loss that we know that students have experienced. But they're getting money both from the state and from the federal government for that too. Some of the American Rescue Plan is going directly to schools specifically for learning loss. There are learning loss grants that the General Assembly passed that are going to schools. If you're a school administrator trying to set out your budget, you're going to have some increased things that you need to spend money on that you don't normally have to think about, but you're getting money specifically for that. So it's another way that, again, there are a lot of opportunities here, I think, for schools to finally really be able to devote that kind of attention to teachers.
And that much harder, I guess, because of those dollars for public schools to cry foul over the awarding of additional dollars for
private school vouchers. I mean, there still will, but again, when you're looking at, when you're awash with cash, I guess a little tougher to get some righteous indignation built up, perhaps. How surprised should we be that in the end, choice was funded to the extent it was? Because this was not just a Republican versus Democratic issue, although we've suggested that it may be. But if you look at the House budget initially, you know, had this program in there, this expansion of the voucher program, but the Senate budget didn't. And then, of course, the money, the floodgates opened and everybody saying kumbaya, and the money was there. But I mean, being surprised isn't the right question. How big a deal is this moving forward for education in the state of Indiana? Does it fundamentally change it, or is this just this will be nice for the small percentage of students who want to take advantage of it?
I think it's tough to say, I guess, if it fundamentally changes it. I mean, to the initial question, does it surprise me? No, it does not surprise me. It's all negotiation. And then especially when we had the extra money coming in, I don't think anyone should have been surprised, because then it was, look, we can still fund traditional K-12 schools and increase the private school voucher program. Everybody wins. You know, like that, I feel like, is kind of how it ended up. I'm curious to see how this does impact the program. I mean, because it is a significant increase in it. So what does that look like going forward?
Well, it's kind of an unknown maybe at this point. You know, Erica, we've had choice now, some variety of that program for 10 years, basically. The pilot program 10 years ago, very small scale, and now it's just sort of blossomed into one of the most aggressive choice, expansive choice programs in the country, even before this latest expansion. Mm-hmm. Now with these dollars there, again, hundreds of millions of dollars potentially, savings accounts, et cetera, does this end that issue? Are we going to hear advocates of private schools back every budget session saying, we got a good thing going, keep that trend line. We want to see, you know, if public schools getting X amount increase in new dollars, well, we're doing our job, so we want it too. Is this just now part of the discussion for the budget for here on out?
Yeah, I think so. I think that the next big discussion is it's going to be doing the same thing that they did with vouchers, right? They started small, they grew it year after year after year. Now they're going to do that with ESAs, right? So we have this new, brand new program, this education scholarship account, and it's starting small. They're capping it at $10 million. It's only for special education families, and I think we're going to see the same people coming back and trying to do the same thing, adding new categories of students in first, and then expanding that program in the same way.
Erica, the voucher program right now, students in choice get, is it 90% of the per pupil funding?
Everyone gets 90. There used to be tiers of funding, so the higher income families were getting 50 or 70%, but that was another change this year, so everyone gets 90%.
Do you see that conversation going to 100% at some point?
I mean, at this point, I wouldn't be surprised. I don't know where else you go unless they just lift the income eligibility requirement entirely.
Brandon just gave advocates an idea for
I gave them any ideas. The thing that struck me, especially right at the end of session, is we heard Luke Kenley's name a lot. Luke Kenley, former state senator
and budget guru.
Yeah, but the budget architect for the Senate Republicans for several years, almost a decade. Mm-hmm. He was never a fan of the voucher program. And his name was brought up a lot by both Democrats and, in one case, Vanita Becker, a Republican, on the Senate floor about vouchers, because what he said when they passed it 10 years ago was, if you start down this road, it's never going to stop. And he's been absolutely right.
Well, we could obviously talk about this, the implications of this, for the whole show. We've got 10 minutes or so or less, and a lot of territory to cover. One more thing on the budget, though. Cigarette taxes, we've heard talk so much about it, and so much money was spent, huge coalition, lots of high profile, say $2, you know, should it be $1.50, and in the end, nothing. We end up with taxation on vaping, electronic cigarettes. Is this issue gone now, too? This is what, the fifth, sixth, seventh year that we've seen this push?
No, it won't go away. Those who advocate for it are going to continue to advocate for it, because for them, it's not about we want money. There are study after study that says if you raising the cigarette tax is a surefire way to get people to stop smoking in the first place, particularly for young people, and to help them quit smoking. And that sort of price point where that behavior starts to change is at least $1 per pack. And it's really like $2 per pack, which is what advocates have pushed for. But we finally heard from Senate Republicans, I think, the reason why it's certainly not going to happen anytime soon, which is they are terrified that at some point the federal government is just not going to contribute nearly as much to the Medicaid program as they are right now. That at some point the state is going to have to shoulder a considerably higher burden of Medicaid funding than it does now. And if and when that happens, now I'll be skeptical that it happens, but if it happens,
Probably not under this federal administration.
But if that happens, I think Senate Republicans are looking to the cigarette tax then as the way you get that
then
money.
Then it's not about behavior modification. Then it really is. All right. You were on a couple months ago at the midpoint, and we broke this down into themes. We talked about, and one of the themes was, is this the pick on the governor session? He didn't get his way on a lot of things. In the end, of course, again, everybody was smiles. He said, oh, it was great collaboration. We saw the news conference. But, I mean, pregnancy accommodation or women accommodations for pregnant women, there was a bill passed, but it was a shadow of what people wanted. He sort of said his comeback was, I'm going to issue an executive order that applies to state employees. Great. But you also saw he was at odds with the state on wetlands protection, whether to scale it back dramatically. We could just go on and on. The curbing of reining in of his emergency powers, that's probably the biggest example. So in the end, is this a win or a loss session for Eric Holcomb?
You know, I almost want to consider it a wash, because when you look at what was on his legislative agenda, there was not a whole lot new on that legislative agenda. But when you look at what was on it, he kind of got what he wanted. You know, he got money for broadband, and he got more money for education, and some of these little things here and there. Again, nothing earth-shattering, but he got those things. He did not get pregnancy accommodations, and that was on his agenda. But it was all these other things that weren't on his agenda that came up and kind of went after him, like, you know, trying to curb his powers during emergencies. You know, he didn't like the wetlands bill. So far he's vetoed two bills, which is, I think, more than any other session. I think in the other ones he's only vetoed one.
Wasn't his tenant rights? No, he had one other, I think. But, I mean, basically he had two veto overrides, too. One early in the session
from last year, and then
one sort of bookends on the session.
Exactly, yeah, and that's striking, given that he's a Republican and these are Republican supermajorities.
Well, if you're looking at his session where right after the session ends, the governor has to sue the General Assembly, it's probably not a total win.
Well, I mean, Erica, to that point, are we going to see this court battle, or again, will everybody try to play nice? Because even when there was division, you saw him talking about great collaboration. You saw lawmakers saying, basically, we think he's done a terrific job. It's just, you know, we want to make sure that basically the next guy or gal doesn't run afoul of our wishes and mandates. Do you see happiness and collaboration moving forward, or is there some sting that's left from this session
between the governor and the that needs to get figured out? That's for sure.
And
you didn't see him do the same thing. You know, other veto overrides, he just kind of took it. This one he did not. So I don't think that goes away. As far as, I don't know, the next session, it's hard to say. I think everyone will pretend to play nice like they always do. But
we should point out, too, that when we say no party's monolithic. So when we say the made reference to the same party, there's disagreement. But I think probably the Senate President pro tem, where there's a supermajority of Republicans in the Senate, and the House Speaker, where there's a supermajority in the House, would say that they can attest to the fact there is not a monolithic approach to party, because I'm guessing herding the proverbial cats there was a chore. Lots of flavors of Republicanism, I guess, in the state of Indiana. The other theme we talked about midterm was the notion of, is the General Assembly losing respect or has it lost respect for home rule? The notion that the government that works best is that which is closest to the people. Local government should have the say. And we saw, you know, a mixed bag there. We saw the notion that wind turbines can't be shoved down wind farms, and it can't be shoved down locals' throats. But I guess cell towers, to a certain extent, can. And you could go right down the line. You know, there's not any state oversight necessarily of the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department, but there will be basically more zoning authority for the excluded cities in Indianapolis. So, I mean, there's a lot of monkeying around there. Is this who, in the end, and I hate to make this always sound like it's a sporting event with winners and losers, but I mean, are locals sort of breathing a sigh of relief and saying, "Whew, we dodged a bullet," or?
I'm going to borrow from Lindsay. I think it's a wash. I think it was, and certainly at the halfway point, it was looking a lot worse for local governments than it ultimately ended up being. They backed away for one reason or another from some of those things. Notably, for instance, here in Marion County, the Indigo Bill, that, despite Aaron Freeman's best efforts to just screw them to the wall
essentially
in every way, shape, and form.
The House
just was not willing to go along with it at the end of the day. We saw the wind turbine bill die, but we also saw a bill that makes it harder for local health officials to impose emergency rules that go farther than any state emergency rules during a time
of public crisis. Of course, lawmakers will probably say, but that's because we're giving more authority to the elected.
Yeah, and that's
six of one half.
That's absolutely an argument. So, yeah, that I would call a wash for locals.
Is this a new reality for locals that every year they're going to have to fight back the?
I don't know if it's new. I think this has been ongoing for the city of Indianapolis for quite some time.
Yeah, the notion of exemption.
And some other cities would make those arguments as well. It's been going on for a while. I think of the plastic bag ban in Bloomington years ago.
Preemption is the word I'm looking for, yeah.
For Indianapolis, you know, I think it could have been a lot worse for them. You know, we saw the Indigo Bill die, well, in various shapes and forms, because that got amended into certain things along the way. But the zoning bill that ended up getting passed and giving excluded cities, you know, zoning authority, I'm sure city officials are not thrilled about that one. But, you know, there was not a takeover of the police department. And so it was some of these, like, bigger issues died. And so I think there is a little bit of, like, a sigh of relief. I mean, certainly at Indigo, there's a sigh of relief.
We're down to a minute. You get the last word here, Erica, and that is we're not done with the session. We still have redistricting to deal with. Supposedly, it'll just be dealing with that, not a special session, the session, resumption part two. Is that really going to be the case, or are we going to see who knows what in the hopper?
Oh, that's a good question, and I don't have a good answer for it. They said it's only going to be redistricting. I want to take them at their word on it. I'm not sure, though. I think it depends what happens between now and then, too.
Because we'll have 10 years of grousing afterwards. Are we going to see any surprises, anybody, in our closing seconds out of the session, out of this, again, I keep wanting to say special session, this special, quote-unquote, session?
I think Speaker Houston, Senator Bray are really going to try to
police that. All right. There we go. Thank you. We did cover a lot of territory. We'll talk about the rest after the cameras are off here. Again, my guests have been Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting, Lindsay Erdody of WFYI, and Erica Herron of the Indianapolis Star. I thank you all very much. Great job this session. Your readers, viewers, listeners should be appreciative of your efforts. For more information, episode streams, and other extra content, visit us on the web at wfyi.org/lawmakers. Well, that concludes another edition and another season of Indiana Lawmakers, the state's longest-running public affairs program. I'm John Schwannis, and on behalf of WFYI Public Media, Indiana's other public broadcasting stations, commentator Ed Feigenbaum, and producer Brad McQueen, I thank you for joining us, and I invite you to come back in January for the start of the General Assembly's 2022 session and Indiana Lawmakers' 41st season. Until then, take care.